welcome to TDF Talks, a fortnightly podcast from The Design Files, Australia's most popular design blog. I'm Lucy Fagans, and I'm the founder and editor of The Design Files. This is episode 31, and it's the first episode in our fourth series. Thank you so much for joining us. Today's episode is brought to you by Fisher & Paykel. We recently hosted two TDF Talks events at Fisher & Paykel's Experience Centre in Alexandria in Sydney. It was so brilliant to bring these in-conversation events to our Sydney audience. Our conversation with Penelope Seidler was recorded live at Fisher & Paykel in Sydney earlier this month. Penelope Seidler is so accomplished, her list of professional achievements is almost impossible to summarise succinctly. She's an architect and an accountant. She's a member of the National Gallery of Australia Foundation Board and has been a director of the Biennale of Sydney since 2010. She sits on the board of the Institute of Architects Foundation in Sydney. She was deputy commissioner for the Australian Pavilion at the 2013 Venice Biennale. And she's been a member of the International Council of the Museum of Modern Art in New York since 1973. To top all this off, in 2008, she was acknowledged as a member of the Order of Australia. Despite these many accolades, many of us may know her best as the wife and professional partner of Harry Seidler and director of architectural firm Seidler & Associates, which continues to operate to this day. I was thrilled and a little starstruck to chat with Penelope recently about her early life, her experience working with Harry in the 1960s, her insights into Australian design and architecture, and the proudest achievement of her career to date. It was truly such an honour to meet Penelope, and it's a conversation I certainly won't forget. I'm really glad we recorded it for you.
I'm going to get into, obviously, architecture, art and design in a moment, but I do love to start these conversations with a little bit of background. So would you mind telling us a little about your early years and I guess what drew you to the world of architecture and design in the first place?
Well, my early years was in Sydney as a schoolgirl. I lived at Wurunga, went to school, and I really didn't know much about architecture. But believe it or not, my father was Minister for Housing for some years in the state government, and so architecture was very much talked about. And I didn't really know much about architecture till I met my husband. And I met him when I was 18, and I was a student at Sydney University doing arts. And we always knew that the architecture students were the most interesting because they wore nice clothes and they had black pencils and they drew on things and much more exotic than all the medical students or the law students.
And you're speaking to a room of architects and designers.
So I guess through knowing architecture students, one thing led to the other and I met my future husband and I became, you know, indoctrinated, I suppose you could say, and really absolutely enthralled with that whole world of doing real things rather than law, which is somewhat, you know, abstract. Arts is wonderful because you learn about culture, but the idea of actually building wonderful things for people and the aesthetics of it and a whole new world of aesthetic interpretation really appealed to me. So I got married, well, only about a year and a half later in December 58 on my 20th birthday. And early in 1959, I embarked on an architecture degree, encouraged by my husband because he said, oh, you're going to be wonderful at it. And I said, well, I don't know whether I'm really cut out for it. But I did it and I enjoyed it, but I really don't think I'm the world's best architect. However, having said that, I think I'm a very good critic and I understand it very well. And it was a wonderful thing to do. And my husband and I had a great collaboration.
Mm. Yeah. So you met Harry Seidler in 1957.
That's correct. Yep.
Can you tell us a bit about, well, firstly, how you met and also what you remember about him and about that time in your life?
Well, I've said a bit about that already, but yes, I met him at some APRE party. There was, I don't know what it was, but there was something at a friend's apartment, and Harry arrived with another lady. Well, they'd been to something else. And actually, it's very interesting because I'm trying to think of her name, but she later went on to marry Peter Hall, who was the follow-on architect for the Opera House. Libby Bryant was her name, yeah. And so, you know, it was a very sort of in-group of architectural people. And Harry and I struck up a conversation, and it was interesting. It was interesting. He was more interesting than other people, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
So that's all I can say about that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So then, as you said, you studied architecture and you went on to work at Sadler & Associates, both as an architect and a financial manager of the firm.
Well, I didn't do – look, the thing that happened was I did my architecture degree and I became an architect and I was working in the office and I liked building models and I wasn't such a great draftsman because I'm left-handed and the machines weren't – built for left-handed. I mean, we're talking ancient history, long before computers, of course, but even most T-squares and everything were all designed for the right-handed. And I don't think I was an ace draftsman, but I liked building models and I liked doing some drawings. But and then I had a couple of children, well, along the way. But when I came back to the office, it seemed to me that really what they needed was somebody managing because Harry was sort of a bit lost with all that and nobody else really wanted to do it. And I started gravitating to that area and I thought, well, you know, I like numbers, I like maths. And I thought, well, I'm going to get into this. So I did a degree in business and qualified as an accountant. And really, that's what they needed there, more than all these whiz people that could do all the drafting and everything.
Yeah. There's probably some architecture firms today that could still do with, you know, an accountant.
Yeah, and I mean, I was obviously very involved with the other, but everybody breathed a sigh of relief.
So I'm really interested to learn about what the business looked like in those early days. Of course, now Sadler & Associates is a name that we all know and it's a household name, but I'm interested to know what the business looked like at that time. Like how many staff did you have and how many projects were you taking on at that?
Well, when I first met Harry, he worked in his basement apartment in Point Piper. Admittedly, the basement department was on the waterfront at Point Piper, where he paid 30 shillings a week rent, and that's where we spent our first year of married life. And it was a very small practice, you know, like he had maybe one or two helpers. And when we got married, and I spent my first year living in that apartment. Well, it wasn't an apartment, it was a room. It's illustrated in books if you can look at it. Very glamorous. But I said to Harry, look, I'm not going to have the office in the bedroom. So he took an office, his first proper office at Caltex House in Sydney. And that's where he met Dick Dusseldorp because they were on the same floor. Well, actually, they had built Caltex House. He's the man who went on to found Civil and Civic and Lendlease.
Yeah.
And that's where we became, you know, we had a relationship.
So we look back, obviously, on the work of Sadler & Associates now and particularly the work that was happening in the 60s as just, you know, iconic examples of Australian architecture. But I'm interested to know what your experience was and Harry's experience at that time because I guess I'm trying to understand if you had a feeling at that time in the 60s and 70s that you guys were doing really pioneering stuff or that you were really shaping Australian design culture. Did you have a sense for that when you were in the thick of it?
Well, even when I met Harry, because he'd come from America and had a European background, his work had been published in Europe and the United States in lots of publications. And he had developed quite a high international reputation in the 50s and 60s. It sort of waned a bit later because so many other people in the act. But no, it was very simple, really. It was very simple. I just knew it was worth following. I knew that we were on a good track, and I believed in modernism, and I was somewhat messianic about it, you know?
Yeah.
And, no, it was very interesting. The office wasn't large, or his name was very well known, but we were always struggling for work.
And I'm interested also to know in, I guess, the public perception of architecture and design at that time, because, again, we look back now at the 60s, and, I mean, that was a time when the Sydney Opera House was being built at that time, and there are so many examples of architecture and design at that time that we now look back on and revere. But at the time that you guys were designing and building that stuff, were you supported? Was it culturally acknowledged, the importance of what you were doing, or not really?
Well, yes and no. I mean, there's always some people that admire what you do, and there's a lot of people that don't admire what you do. But the Opera House is a good example because winning competition was announced in January 1957, and I remember it well, opening the newspaper and seeing that design. And on that very day, Harry wrote, that's before I met Harry, he wrote to the newspaper saying, this is a work of poetry and wonderful and, you know, should be supported. And when Jorn Utzon came to Australia for the first time later that year, and by then I knew Harry and I met him, and, you know, people were a little, I don't think they were particularly interested in the Opera House at that stage, but, you know, he was enthusiastic, and there wasn't all that much, there was some criticism of it. But the criticism came later when it was in construction and, of course, the price went up and it took too long. I mean, what's new? and then it became very nasty, very nasty. Yeah. And I remember it very well because we were great friends of Jorn Utzon. And when he first arrived, as I said, we met him and Harry had a party for him at Rose Sidler House, because he had a wonderful mother who would cook and entertain whenever he insisted, you know.
Yeah.
And I met Jorn Utzon then, and we became good friends. And, you know, he was wonderful, and everybody was sort of onside a bit, but it became so political afterwards. That was just horrible. And then it became very nasty, you know, we don't need foreigner coming here and all that stuff, and it's costing too much, and you've all read all the books. But it was very unpleasant, and he left, and I remember Harry saying to me, he'll never come back. I know he'll never come back.
Yeah.
And he never did.
Yeah.
But his daughters and children, brothers, they come back.
And so did that sort of sentiment of what was going on with the Opera House at that time, did that sort of feed into public sort of perception of architecture more generally? Like, I'm just sort of interested to know, you know, these days I feel like there's sort of an appreciation for architecture more broadly. The general public are sort of interested in buildings and home design and that sort of thing. And I'm wondering if at that time people were interested in architecture, or if they thought you guys were sort of crazy creatives?
Well, I don't think they thought much about it at all. But I do think that Harry actually put architecture on the map in a way, because when I look back on all the records and, you know, press clippings, when the building he built for his parents, the Rose Sidler House, in the late 40s or 50, and it won the Sulman Award, there was this huge publicity. And people used to go there. I mean, they'd go into the private driveway and they'd, you know, his mother was, well, she wasn't frightened, but it was an invasion of privacy in a way. And I think people were talking about architecture in a way that they never did before. And even when I became involved in these things and we built our house, that's not till the 60s, people would say, oh, who's going to clean the windows? That was, you know, that was a popular retort. And the other thing was, don't you find it hard on your feet to walk on hard surfaces? And I used to say no. And when they'd say, who cleans the windows? I'd say, oh, I haven't thought about that yet. But, I mean, you know, people were sort of amazed by these concepts that a room isn't just a little box, a little rectangle, that it was open space. And I think a lot of people took to it, but they probably didn't get the finer points of what the architecture was about, but they're more interested in the practical aspects. But it did create a huge buzz, I know that.
Yeah, well, it still does to this day. I mean, you know, that legacy is so, it almost, well, you can tell me if you feel this way. Do you feel like the legacy of the work that you and other firms were doing at that time is almost stronger today than it's ever been before?
You mean from that time?
Yeah, the architecture of the 60s. It just feels like right now there is so much passion.
Oh, yes.
Passion.
Well, it was more robust in a way because, well, my opinion about architecture today is not all that good because it's gone all over the place. It's gone all over the place. And I blame it not only on computers, because you can plug into a computer and it can do all sorts of things, which we never could. But, you know, building techniques are so advanced now that you can almost do anything. So the rationality has somewhat disappeared. And I find that rather distressing, actually. You know, people don't think so much about structure or what makes common sense in building, because you can do bloody anything. You can do anything, and they do.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's all over the place. I mean, nothing seems to draw it together.
Yeah. So I'm also interested in your experience as a woman and a mother working at that time and being a very big part of a very prolific business. What was your experience like working alongside Harry at that time and I guess being a manager of that firm? Was it unusual?
Oh, well, people always used to say, oh, I suppose you do the interiors. Women's work, you know, interiors. And, well, I don't know what I said to that, but that was the norm, that women did the interiors. Well, there weren't so many women architects around, and I don't think I'm the right person to ask about that because, after all, I was married to a high-profile real designer architect. But there weren't too many around, and I've got to say that even now, I think it's very hard for women, and we've got women in our office too, and I think it's very hard for women to get the same recompense for what they do as the guys, because I've seen a lot of that.
Yeah.
And I think it's tough but very worthwhile.
Yeah.
So it's getting better. It's getting better, but it's not there yet.
Yeah. Mm. And what were your – give us an insight into your, I guess, your daily life at that time. So you had young children and you were working in this firm and, you know, you're incredibly
busy.
Well,
I was working, but I did have the option of being sort of part-time.
Yeah.
So, but I was always sort of around, but I didn't have to clock on and off every day. It wasn't – you know, I had special privileges.
Well, I feel like you just probably never clocked off, even when you would have been talking about work all night and it wouldn't have been.
Yeah. Well, that's true. I mean, there was no other world, actually.
I get that sense. So, of course, you are still the director of the company and very involved in architecture and design and culture today. You sort of touched on it before, but I'd love to sort of revisit that point about architecture now and I guess some of the challenges that you see facing architects today.
Well, I think architecture's sort of off the table, really. People, it's diminished, you know. They don't when they put in the newspaper or on the television the new projects, you have to search to see who the architect is. They're just treated like chattels, and they have to put in submissions for fees, and it's tough. It's a tough world. And actually, I'll tell you something. I was privileged a couple of weeks ago that the Property Council of Australia, who, you know, represent all the powers in that world, gave the Hall of Fame award to Harry Seidler and me. I mean, I think it was more him than me, but never mind, they did. First time given to an architect. And what was interesting was that I got up in Canberra and spoke, and I said, one of the things I said, thank them and all that gracious stuff. And I said, you know, really what's remembered about major buildings is the architect. And when you look back in history and you look at all the great buildings in the world, it's known by the architect in most cases, often built by so-and-so. And I quoted various examples. Well, apparently it created quite a I've had lots of feedback on that. Yeah, it gave all those people something to think about, and let's hope they think more about it, because it is a very important thing, because architects give the physical legacy to what's there, the creative thing. I mean, you know, you can be good with the numbers and buy up the property and get through the authorities, which is very difficult these days. But in the end, what do people look at? The building.
Yeah.
So let's hope I've had a little incremental point there.
I'm sure you have. So that also brings me to a point about preserving buildings, particularly there's a lot of interest at the moment in, you know, preserving buildings that are under threat, particularly from the 60s and 50s, maybe less or so in the 70s. But I'm just wondering your thoughts about preserving important buildings, and what do you think makes a building worthy of preserving or being heritage listed?
Well, it has to be culturally significant, and within that definition, it's very hard to describe often. But no, I think it's good, but I don't think people have quite worked out which are the right ones. And sometimes it's very political, of course, as you know, particularly in this state. And we've had the recent example of the Sirius building, which let's hope now has come to an okay solution.
Yeah.
Yet to be determined, but looks okay.
Yeah.
It's difficult because sometimes it can frustrate something that's worthwhile.
Yeah.
And, you know, heritage is such a loaded word.
Yeah.
Some people think that heritage is backward. You know, that you're only looking at what's gone and not what's coming, the future. I guess that's inevitable, really. It's yeah. difficult to say what's worth preserving and what's not. But I think there has to be some sort of consensus on it.
And I'm wondering more broadly if you have any thoughts on, I guess, the future of Australian cities. I mean, Sydney and Melbourne in particular are growing at an astronomical rate. There's, you know, been a big growth in our population, and it will continue to grow. So cities do need to be getting bigger. We need more density in our housing. And I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on, I guess, where our cities might be headed.
Well, I don't think they're doing all that well, actually. Well, it comes down to a lack of planning, and when I say planning, I mean it in the broader sense. And there's a lack of comprehensive planning for a whole city, I think both Sydney and Melbourne. And local councils are not the answer. I was disappointed. I know I speak against a lot of people, but there was a move here to amalgamate councils, which went down in flames a couple of years ago. But I thought it was a good move, and I think the more amalgamation, the better. And I like the Brisbane model better, where they just have one council for the whole of Brisbane. And there should be a plan of where strategically where the high density should go. And I mean, at the moment they have it so around the transport hubs. That's sensible. But within all that, it's a mess. It's a mess. And we can see it. We're around here even. You know, you get buildings too close together and it's sad. It's very sad.
And do you think that culturally Australians need to sort of change their perception of the Australian home? Because, I mean, we sort of need to start living in smaller homes and apartments, I think. Mm. What are your thoughts on, I guess, changing that cultural expectation?
Well, I think it's happening. I've always referred to houses rather than homes. I mean, home has a sort of sanctified status, which is sort of quite sweet, but the idea of everybody having a little house on a quarter acre block is, I think, long over. But the tragedy is that it's still going on the extremities and people still seem to want that. But I think it is changing. A lot of young people now would rather have an apartment in where the action is, you know. And it's all wrong because in Vienna, where we built, they don't allow any buildings until the schools are there, the infrastructure, the transport. Then you can build to their master plan of not the architecture, but what sort of density and, you know, the more or less the location of the buildings. But here it's the other way around. They build these pathetic little houses, and I call them pathetic because I think it is very sad, and they've got nothing. They've got no transport, infrastructure. They have to have a car and drive 50 kilometres to a job. I mean, it's a way to cause trouble. So I don't know how to change that, but I think it will change, but only because it's so desperate that it has to.
What role do you think architects, and I'm assuming there's a few in the room tonight, what role do you think architects might be able to play in those discussions? Because, I mean, my feeling is the people that make decisions around planning and that sort of legislation isn't necessarily highly engaged with the people that design homes and
well, that's the point. I mean, they're not really at all. I mean, architects have been reduced in their importance. And I think that's a shame. And we've just got to raise their reputation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do also get the sense that I think that, well, I've only been running my website for 11 years, but I do get a sense, even in the last 5 years, that there is a really renewed public interest in architecture and design and a public awareness, even from people that live in a rented home and may not be able to afford to design or build their own home, that they're interested and there's sort of a public, yeah, interest and I guess people care about.
Well, I think you're right. There is an interest, but I think within that interest, they're not quite sure how to navigate it.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's all sorts of stuff around and internet and everything, but you know, you can go off on tangents and I think it's hard to find an answer, but it's good that people are interested now.
Yeah.
And I believe now that, you know, old furniture of the, you know, brown furniture, as they call it, is what out and nobody wants that anymore. Well, yeah. It's a long time since I've had anything to do with it, but, you know, modern is in.
Yeah, yeah.
Modern, I mean, modern is quite old, but it's in.
Yeah. It's back. You also have a great passion for art. To be honest, when I was trying to succinctly write my introduction to you tonight, I just can't fathom how much you do, how many boards you're on and your various passions and the things you contribute to. But tell us about your passion for art and where that came from and how that's evolved.
Well, I don't know where it came. My parents were always interested in art. And, you know, when I was at high school, art was a dropout subject, didn't count for the matriculation. And so none of the smart kids did art at school. Thank God it's changed. And when I went to Sydney University, I would have loved to have studied history of art and art. No, not available. Not until the Power Institute became in the mid-60s. But when I studied architecture, I was very fortunate that Lloyd Rees and Roland Wakelin both taught us art, and Lloyd Rees particularly taught us history of art. And I can still remember his words when I stand in front of the great paintings of the world, and with such passion and love. He was a wonderful person. And my husband, of course, who was taught by three Bauhaus masters, had a passion for art. And so I developed more and more of that, and I became a gallery guide at the Art Gallery of New South Wales for a while, but I had too many other obligations. And I got involved as a consumer of art. I don't paint myself or not very well. But no, I got a great passion for it. And through the Museum of Modern Art, from all those years, I was invited to join their International Council in the 70s. And I've had the opportunity to experience wonderful museums and collections and be part of an international art scene. And through the biennales, because I've been going to both the art biennales and the architecture biennales for the last 30 years or more for the art. And, you know, I just enjoy it a lot. And, of course, we've been able to select great artists for clients. You know, Harry and I toured the world in 1965 at the behest of Dick Dusseldorp, who wanted to... He was very ambitious, and he said, I want you, to Harry, he said, to tour the world and select the best artists for a major work at Australia Square. And then I went too. I took a couple of weeks off from studying, 3 weeks off actually, and then he said to Harry, it's not just a second honeymoon, you know. And Harry was appalled because he was... always had work on his mind. Anyway, we went and we had an amazing trip. We visited Henry Moore and Isamu Noguchi, but we ended up with Alexander Calder, and we visited him both in France and in America, and they got on so well. And he was very excited about the site being an urban site, whereas Henry Moore was fine. He was interested in doing it, but he wasn't particularly enthused by the site. I mean, he said, oh, well, this, you know, this sculpture and that, and we can do one like this. But he didn't sort of warm to fitting it into the architectural location. And Noguchi was, well, he was a bit preoccupied with other things, but he wanted to do it. And anyway, Calder won, and, you know, we're all the lucky for it, because he was known at that time, but not as big as he is now. There's a wonderful exhibition of his now in Melbourne, yeah, which you've probably seen. Have you?
At the National Gallery of Victoria at the moment, there's an Alexander Calder show.
So we had wonderful experiences like that with artists. And I was very involved in the selection of artworks, because we always thought of the art at the inception of the design. When the design came, well, what, you know, where would you place the art and what sort of thing would it be? Rather than, as many architects or some, I won't say, an add-on at the end, yeah. You know, oh, yes, we've got to think of something that, plonk on the wall.
That sounds like a dream assignment, to just travel the world for 3 weeks and meet all these incredible...
Oh, yes, it was quite amazing.
Yeah. That wouldn't happen today. Not in the same way anyway.
No, well, these days, of course, it wouldn't happen, because you just plug into the internet and see this and you write it, you know. But communications were a completely different thing then. I mean... a telephone call to the other side of the world was a big deal, long before fax or any of that other stuff.
Yeah. Mm.
So you are still incredibly dedicated to your work and to the studio and your various other professional commitments that I mentioned. Tell us what Seidler & Associates looks like today.
Oh, well, it's still going strong. We're at 10 people. I would say mostly, but not totally, involved with new work at our historical buildings.
Yeah.
But there's some new work too.
Yeah.
And no, it's good because I get very upset when other people modify our buildings.
Yes.
And I think that's one thing that, should be stressed, that if people want to alter a building, they should go back to the architect. I'm sure everyone in the room agrees with that. And they don't always, although they're obliged to tell them, but they want to reinvent the wheel every day. But anyway, we're doing work in Brisbane, Sydney, Melbourne, Perth, and, major buildings have major works going on all the time. And one very nice work that we're involved with is a house in Mossman, which was 1952 or 3, the so-called igloo house. And finally, the person that bought it before Harry died, I mean, it was a long time ago, it's on the heritage list. He bought it and he was going to restore it, and then he bought the land next door and he was going to build this in it. So over 20 years this has been going on, if not 25. Anyway, we're doing it now. We're doing it now, and it's going to be so fabulous. It's the best site in Sydney.
Oh, wow.
Parowee Road, Mossman.
Mm. Well, I'm going to see if I can wangle a shoot
no,
there.
No, it's going to be fantastic.
And what does what does a typical week look like for you? You're still very involved in the studio.
I'm there every day. Not all day every day, but like I got there at 11 this morning and then I left to come here and got lost. And no, I'm also on the board of the Sydney Living Museums. And
No,
it's busy. And I like to go to plays and operas and theatre and, I'm busy.
Yeah. Mm. And you travel all the time because
I don't travel all the time. Some of the time.
Okay. Well, all I remember is when we were trying to organise a date for this evening, it was hard to catch you.
I took a while to get, didn't I? Because I thought, I'm never going to do this again. But
thank you.
She was very persistent.
I hope you don't go home regretting your decision.
No, what finally did was you sent me one with Mary Featherstone, was it? And I thought that was very nice. So I thought, I'll do that.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. You're so efficient too. When I sent Penelope emails, I just send the longest emails. I really need to work on my email etiquette. I'll send her like an essay of here's what we're doing, here's the questions I'll ask you. And you write the most efficient responses. You literally write a one sentence answer. That sounds great. And I'll be like, is that a yes? But I appreciate the efficiency. Mm. Anyway, thanks for being here. I've just got a couple more questions and then we might throw open to the room. You've done so many incredible things in your career. To me, it feels like you've lived five lives. But
I've been around a long time.
Still, though, it feels like you get a lot done. But if you had to name one thing, what would you say has been one of your proudest achievements?
Well, I'm very proud of the fact that next to our office in Milsons Point, they were going to build a building on the Luna Park site, which would have been very harmful to our building. And this was when my husband had had a stroke and he was dying. And I thought, I just can't let this happen. I just can't let this happen. And I used all the power I had, and it was I don't have much power. But I finally got an interview with the Minister for Planning, and it took me months and months to do that. And I convinced him that what they were doing was wrong because they had a lease for 100 years for $1 and they were going to build this building. And when I made it plain to him and he had all these henchmen around, and he said, "Is this true?" And they all went, "Oh, well, it's not quite, you know." And he got really angry because he wasn't aware fully of the facts. Anyway, I had to pay a lot of money, several million dollars, to acquire the right for that site. And what I did was made a park, and I made a park called Harris Park, and it's next to our office, and it's very beautiful. And I did it all by myself, and I'm very proud of that.
That is an incredible achievement. I can just imagine you turning up with your paperwork and, you know, 20 men at a boardroom table.
It was amazing because once I revealed the facts, they all went to water.
Well, we're very lucky for that. Yeah. And is there anything that you haven't done yet that you'd love to do?
Plenty I haven't done.
But what's on your bucket list of something you'd still really love to do in the next few years?
Oh, I just want to stay at home and sort out things at home.
I feel like if there's anything that's not going to get done, it's that.
I just want to sort through. I've got so much stuff. I just want to sort it out and maybe write something.
Oh, yeah. Right.
Yeah, but I never have time.
Have you written a book?
No.
Oh, okay. Well, there's still time.
I've got the title, though, The Architect's Wife.
I think that's downplaying things just a little.
Penelope Seidler is on Instagram. You can follow her at Penelope Seidler. Harry Seidler and Associates continues to operate under Penelope's leadership. You can learn more about their past and current projects at seidler.net.au. There was also a little bit of discussion in this conversation about the future of Sydney's Sirius building. You can see the latest update on that building and the current plans for its redevelopment via the link in our show notes. You've been listening to TDF Talks, a podcast from The Design Files, Australia's most popular design blog. Today's episode was recorded live at Fisher & Paykel in Sydney. Fisher & Paykel is committed to research, development and collaboration and works closely with architects and designers to seamlessly integrate their appliances into kitchens in innovative ways. Visit www.fisherandpaykel to find out more. Please do also check out our website, thedesignfiles.net, where we post new stories 3 times a day featuring Australian design, art, architecture and more. And you can follow us on Instagram at thedesignfiles. Thank you so much for tuning in. And if you've enjoyed this first episode in our 4th season, please subscribe to TDF Talks on iTunes. Thanks so much for listening and see you soon.